Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have in the studio in New York, the Carnegie Hall studio, Rudolf Wurlitzer. And the occasion is the republication by a wonderful small press called $2 Radio of his first three books. Those books were Nog, Flats, and Quake. They came out respectively in 1968, 1970, and 1972. I thought it would be interesting to go back to that period, to 1968, and see where these books came from, what allowed them to be. I think the three books, which, you know, are sometimes called a trilogy, although I don't think they were written specifically as a trilogy, were they?
No, actually they weren't. They were written quite separately.
But looking back on them in time, they seem to share themes with one another that Rudolf Wurlitzer's later novels don't share with them. Those are Slow Fade and Drop Edge of Yonder. You've heard about them on Bookworm. During the time when these novels were being published, Rudolf Wurlitzer, in accord with really old Hollywood traditions, was invited to Hollywood. I was talking with, you know, someone who was back from the old Hollywood of the 40s and 50s, Irving Ravitch, and he'd say to me, MGM had the best writers. They would bring Daniel Fuchs, the author of the Williamsburg trilogy, and he was working there. Everyone gathered in the writers' building, and this was still a time, because the studios were fresh in the throes of dying, when writers were being invited. And a young writer who seemed to have written a very unusual and intelligent new novel, Rudolf Wurlitzer, his novel was Nog, was being asked, would he consider to write screenplays? Who was it who talked to you?
Well, actually,
then?
Monty Hellman called me. He had read Nog, and he was sort of mesmerized by it, I guess, and liked it a lot. And he was looking for someone to write this script about being on the road. And it was, you know, it was interesting. It was. I said, of course, you know, I was looking for a way to finance my next weird book. So it was great. And it was an adventure. And I'd been in L.A. drifting around without being in the movie business at all. And so Monty, I went to the Chateau Marmont and got a room there and hung out with car people in the valley and learned a new language. And it was really interesting. But the thing that was really unusual, as I look back on it, I see how unusual it was. At the time, I just thought, this is great. This is the way they do things out here. I was completely free. And it was a very open-ended situation. So I can go on my own internal journey with this very external medium, and which was really about, you know, the racing of no racing in a way, you know. So it was all full of existential moments, and with no beginning and no end, with amateur, for the most part, amateur actors, although there were some very funny professionals. But so it was lots of fun. There was no corporate stamp on anything.
Now, Nog had come out. It had been published by Random House, as I remember.
Right, yeah, it was, yeah.
And you had written it. Did you consider yourself a young novelist? Nog seems almost like something else entirely.
Well, I did. You know, I had written, I'd published some short stories, and the first part of Nog was published in, I think, Paris Review. So I considered myself a writer, and my journey at that point was to deconstruct everything that I'd learned in the academic world, which was to say to pull the rug out from underneath the narrative structures that had been imposed on me, you know, in a wonderful way at times, but also I felt quite radical, and I wanted to enlist the darker side of the linear narrative. So I tried to question it and break it down and in a way it was a strategy to dissolve the self, in the sense that the naturalistic self that most novels carried in terms of information and the collective kind of conversation. So it was a radical, you know, I felt very free and no one was telling me what to do. So I was off the grid in a way and preferred to be there, you know. So I don't think I've ever been as free since.
Now, how hard was it for that to be published at that time?
Well, it, you know, strangely enough, it wasn't that hard because, you know, this wonderful editor at Random House, Hal Charlotte, I think he read the piece in the Paris Review, and we got together, and he was tremendously supportive, which is amazing because Random House now, you know, would never do a book like that, you know. So there was this little bubble of time where the orthodox publishing, mainstream publishing houses had a lot of flexibility, as did the film studios. So they weren't corporatized. There weren't some, the salespeople didn't run the show, so to speak. So,
well, it was also,
I was very lucky.
Me, yeah, that what had emerged was a kind of book that editors didn't know how to look for.
Right.
They would find it if they were lucky. I think that in many senses, publishers were conking themselves in the head saying, why didn't we get Naked Lunch?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't we get Last Exit to Brooklyn? Why didn't we get On the Road?
Right.
And now it was noticeable that a whole new generation of readers,
right,
was appearing who were interested in books like that, and both Hollywood studios and New York publishers sensed that this was the way to be aligned with that audience.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, for instance, in L.A., I mean, I think that Tulane Blacktop was really made possible from the success of Easy Rider. So they thought, wow, this is amazing. You can make a film for very little money and, you know, with all these wacky people, and it'll do well. And, you know, for a few seconds that was true, you know.
Yeah. Now, Nog, when I reread it, although I still have and like my little pocketbooks paperback, it actually has the kangaroo on the spine. A kangaroo had a pocket, and I guess the kangaroo stored books in its pocket. And Nog had to be identified, so although it wasn't called this as a hardcover, as a paperback, it's subtitled Headventure. by Rudolf Wurlitzer. Right. And in part for me, that name itself, Rudolf Wurlitzer, sounded like the name of a character in a Pynchon novel. The psychedelic cover and the name of the author, the three-word title, led me to read the book. Now, who was Rudolf Wurlitzer then?
Who was? That's a good question. I'd have to know who Rudolf Wurlitzer is now to answer it. Who I was then, and I don't know either. But I'll try.
Yeah.
But in those days, in '68, there was a tremendous. It was a tremendously intense, free-floating time when the whole country seemed to be imploding. You know, there was the Vietnam War, there was Kent State, there was the first man on the moon in 68 or 9, there was Woodstock. There was this tremendous sense of permission. And people were really, and also the country was fairly well off, so that there was a tremendous sense of flexibility, and people weren't so obsessed with making money, and you could really take a chance. And in those days in New York, I hung out with a lot of really interesting radical artists like Klaus Oldenburg and Rauschenberg, and Klaus was doing Happenings, and I did a short film with him, and that was the first film I ever did. It was completely improvised, and Robert Frank was doing short films that were really off the wall and totally improvised, so that there was a sense of exploration and there was an actual conversation going on in New York with artists, writers, musicians like Phil Glass, Lamont Young, and jazz people like Ornette Coleman and, the Five Spot. And so there was lots of interaction, which doesn't seem to be the case now, but... And the theater with, places like La Mama and early experimental theater that was going on in those days, Mabu Mines and places like that, public theater. It was a very thrilling time to be in New York. You could be poor and didn't matter, rents were cheap, conversation was plenty, So it was like a surge into the unknown. So that sense, it was a kind of mental frontier, so to speak, when the whole the rigidities of the past culture were breaking down, and there was a great permission and almost euphoria about it. So in that sense, it was a wonderful time, despite all the violence and fear of about what was happening in the world.
Now, let's not forget, too, that at the same time, there was really something happening in novels.
Yes, that's true.
On the one hand, there was, I think as never before, an effort to... Even if we skip the nonsense of, trying to write the great American novel, and there was the resurrection, the rediscovery of Melville, of Henry James. Strangely, people forget it, mm-hmm. but those books were being republished by Grove Press, mm-hmm. who were also publishing the hippest young American mm-hmm. writing. And from Europe... often frequently being published by Grove, was arriving the work of Samuel Beckett. Mm-hmm. The novels came first, before the plays, mm-hmm. and not just Beckett, but Robe Grier, mm-hmm. and Natalie Serot, and a whole wave of what fiction could be if it would just get rid of the things that European fiction had been famous for. Those things were...
That's very, really true. I spent time in the mid-60s or early 60s in Paris, and I was probably tremendously influenced by Beckett and Sioran and various French writers, Robespierre and Genet and all that. And that's really where I sort of made my bones, so to speak, and gave me the encouragement and the sense of, you know, going forward with those explorations.
So Nog arrives, and what it is, it seems to me, is an aesthete's version of a rough-and-tumble American book. American books had to go on the road, and they had to rediscover home. This book, Nog, pays a token intention to going back to New York and ends as the character is going back home again.
Sort of the opposite of Steinbeck, so to speak. And the, you know, it's about getting lost rather than finding home, you know.
And it has, you know, the most extraordinary version of a character drifting. We don't know his name. We know he has a driver's license from, I think, Portland, somewhere up north. He begins in California. But he's taken on the name Nog because Nog, a guy named Nog, sold him a fake octopus in a bathysphere, and he's been traveling around with it, showing it in the Midwest and the Southwest in county fairs. He's not a miscreant, he tells us. He can make money. He charges kids a dime and adults a quarter to see the octopus. He's experimenting with not being Nog. He wanders into communes. He finds himself in bedrooms and hallways. The charge to cross his mattress is that you let him feel your feet. You sit down on the bed and talk about problems. Eventually, our character, whose name we never learn, is locked into the pantry and dispenses cans of beans and various goods there. He's taken himself on a road trip that seems oddly like one into gangster territory and then turns into the Old West. So it's sort of like a picture of American culture forming itself in reverse order. You know, it's amazing the time travel that happens in this book.
Yeah, that's true. It was this movement towards what was left of the frontier. We get out to the frontier where you could have permission to reinvent yourself in the wackiness of California, etc. New York was always in the background, pulling one back. But the whole thing was to go further, as Ken Kesey would say, and find ways to deconstruct the culture so that you could reinvent yourself in a way that was completely unknown, you know, that you were embracing the gesture of becoming lost. You were embracing getting rid of your inherited memories, you know, getting rid of what you were programmed to be, you know. So in that sense, Nog was about all of that.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Rudolf Wurlitzer about three books, Nog, Flats, and Quake. All have been reissued by $2 Radio. Nog in one volume, Flats and Quake together in another. We'll continue after this short break. We'll be right back. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Rudolf Wurlitzer about his novels Nog, Flats, and Quake. Now, we're in 1968-some with a book that comes out and leads to a movie, Nog, leading to Tulane Blacktop, and talking in the background about who Rudolf Wurlitzer is. And one of the things I love knowing about Rudolf Wurlitzer, about whom not much is known, is that as a young man, he was training to be a violin virtuoso, and that he had the opportunity to play the violin with Albert Einstein. Would you tell that story? Because I think it goes behind a lot of this.
Well, in the early days, I was born into a music family. Wurlitzer people made organs and jukeboxes and accordions and pianos and all that stuff. And I came along at the end of that run, so that the family fortune were severely challenged, so to speak. But I was raised to in the music world, and at a very young age, in fact, in my crib, somebody put my father or grandfather put a small, tiny violin, and just to give me the signal of what I was in for. So I played the violin, and in those days, when I was in my early teens, my father would drive to. My father had become a stringed instrument dealer. He'd left the company, and the company sort of went down. So he was an amazing expert in all kinds of stringed instruments. But every weekend, or many weekends, he would drive to Princeton, New Jersey, and see Albert Einstein, who was a friend of his, and also Einstein played the violin, and played very badly, I might say, but, you know, and he would ask me to go along, say, hey, I want you to come to Princeton with me. And I'd say, oh, Dad, you know, it's so boring there. I know this old guy. I mean, do you have to drag me along? You know, and he said, no, one day you'll understand. You know, so I'd come and play a little bit with Albert, and then we'd go shopping at the local, grocery store. He loved to push the carts around. And, think about things.
Wow.
So, you know, that was...
Well, it seems to me the eventual deconstruction of time and space in your novels, it's restructuring according to certain fugal or musical principles, recurrences, your later involvement with Philip Glass, all of this is foreshadowed. But do I understand correctly your father would lend Einstein a Stradivarius?
Well, he would, lend him various, wonderful violins to play, because he actually knew who Einstein was. So it was, he felt, he was very fond of him and felt that it was a great privilege to listen to his terrible violin playing.
And you leave Columbia University eventually and start traveling. Is this a compulsive? Is it hitchhiking?
It has been a compulsion for most of my life to be on the move, so to speak. I mean, when I was 16 or 17, I got a job on an oil tanker and went to Kuwait and Morocco and various places. And I was always restless, and I went to Cuba and as a young guy, and then various other places out west all the time, Europe, and lived in Europe for several years, and France and Spain. And so I was always, on the move, so to speak, I don't know what demons were pursuing me, but I still enjoy being on the move,
Now tell me, though, an odd question, but were you regarded as a sort of genius?
No, I wasn't. I think I was, I don't think people knew what to make of me, I was, you know, I was eccentric. I didn't really belong in any slot. So I don't think anyone ever, you know, I don't know what people thought of me, but I think they were confused about me, you know, about what I was up to. And they probably still are.
Well, yes, but then, if I remember correctly, young people were thought to be confusing. And it was thought to confusing times.
Yeah.
So that it was much more possible then, and even likely, for a young person to be forgiven and allowed a certain amount of improvised frenzy.
Yeah. My parents were very, my mother and father didn't really know what I was all up to or all about, but they were very accepting of whatever I wanted to do. I left Columbia for a while, and for a couple of years, went in the army, came back, finished out, went to Europe. They didn't, you know, there was a great sense of permission. I was very fortunate that way, you know. I wasn't under any yoke, you know, to be one thing or the other. So I was the privilege came with this permission to actually go on the drift, you know, and become lost in order to find myself, you know. If I hadn't really just taken off, I wouldn't have found out what I was really thinking about. It would have been a mirror of what somebody else was thinking about, or I would be in some kind of other world. So does that make sense to you?
Of course.
Yeah.
I
You're the same, Michael.
Yes, a double trajectory. I've been talking with Rudolf Wurlitzer. We're going to continue talking with him next week. We're talking about three books, Nog, Flats, and Quake, which have all been re-released by $2 Radio. Nog in one volume, Flats and Quake together in another. Thank you, Rudolf, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read excerpts from Nog, Flats, and Quake at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to recording engineer Leszek Wojcik at Carnegie Studios in New York City. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time with Rudolf Wurlitzer on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.